Welcome back to Schizotopia. As always, I'm your host, Maxwell Cody, and joining me tonight from America's Penis, Mr. Isaac Eager. Isaac, how you doing?
Fantastic. Thanks for having me on. Totally flattered you'd want me on here.
No, a world traveler like you?
I just feel like the stupidest person you've probably had on your show. Like, well, you have people that talk about Jung and like esoteric Catholicism, and I'm just like a dilettante. So, to be amongst these guests is an honor.
I mean, I think the great thing about podcasting is it is a great equalizer, because it isn't always about how smart you are, or how funny you are, or about how weird you are, or anything. I think it can just be about how interesting you are, regardless of those things.
Well, I hope I'm interesting. We'll see.
Well, I wanted to ask you,
can this podcast? I will not be insulted.
No, I gotta get at least 3 episodes done before the end of this month. So there's no canning this
quotas,
one. In fact, there's probably no editing this one. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You're getting quoted in no matter what.
All right.
But you are a native son of Florida. You have a podcast that I think focuses on Florida.
Yes.
What's going on? I know you love DeSantis, but it doesn't look like he's doing good right now.
Oh man. So I had so much hope for him. I thought he was going to, make America Florida. Born and raised in Florida, prodigal son who returned to Florida after really rejecting it. Like my entire childhood, I couldn't stand this place. And I'm back possibly permanently or until it sinks into the sea. DeSantis, wow, what a fall from grace that's been. I think it might be like a historic rise and fall. I can't believe how quickly. This is worse than like Howard Dean. This is worse than who is that Wisconsin guy? Scott Walker. This is precipitous.
I forgot all about Scott Walker.
Yeah.
Saying you think it's over. There's no way he's even going to get the Republican nomination, or is he even going to run officially now? Do you think that's kaputs?
Word on the street here amongst Florida reporters is that he's got his team has a date circled on the calendar, which they're going to announce. It would be very embarrassing for him to not run at this point. I mean, he's on his world tour right now, just signed a second bill in Israel, dismantling the First Amendment again, another anti-BDS bill, basically. And he's also set himself up with so much bad policy here in the state of Florida that I think the plan was always to escape before he had to reap. So I think this is the window for him. I mean,
it's funny to me because the only reason he would need to run now is because he thinks that there's a good chance that Trump could retake the White House. But then even then, why not just wait another 4 years? It just seems like
because
that would be the smarter
move. He won't be governor. His term will be up after the end of 2026. And two years of not being in office, potentially, I think would be catastrophic, because he just won't, people will forget about him. He'll be done.
Well, it's funny that... Well, two things I want to ask you. I mean, one, it's funny that this is kind of defying all laws of electoral politics in the U.S. because, as I've been saying in any other time, and this isn't because I like DeSantis, but I'm saying in any other time, in any other era, a guy like DeSantis would just be the obvious front runner. without a doubt. And somebody like Trump, who had lost the White House and lost the Congress, he would be done. I mean, nobody would be taking him seriously anymore. The party would be moving on. It's only because we're living in this weird time that DeSantis isn't the front runner. But are you saying that DeSantis, because the narrative about DeSantis is that he's been running Florida 110%. At 110%, things are going really well in Florida. You know, we want this guy to make America Florida is kind of what his supporters are saying. And sure, you're saying, I'm getting the feeling that you're implying that it's kind of a house of cards and he wants to graduate to the White House before he has to actually deal with how he set Florida up.
Yeah, I think that the narrative that Florida is running at 110%, I mean, it depends on for who you're talking about. I think if you are a corporate lobbyist or if you're a high-powered attorney, yeah, dude, you love DeSantis. You love what he's doing. But for just about everybody else, it's not so great. I mean, he played a really good move during COVID, opening up the state before anybody else, even if he had previously shut it down and did some weird vaccination shenanigans, including like get the J&J himself and brag about it. But yeah, it's already falling apart. I mean, the Disney thing, which was supposed to be, you know, the biggest trophy on his mantle, it has already, like, it's already done. Like, already fucked up. The people who he put in charge of the Reedy Creek Improvement District, which was like the Disney Vatican status, literally just like didn't read a contract and signed it anyway, and that gave Disney, like, it undid everything that DeSantis had previously done to take power away from Disney. So it's already falling apart, and you can see it happening like in real time.
So now he's kind of backed into a corner where he has to run for president. And but what I last heard is that the Florida Republicans are not going to be endorsing him, the people in his own backyard.
I mean, it's pretty crazy. I'm really blown away by it, because I only know of one Florida legislator who has endorsed him. I think more than 11 have already endorsed Trump, including my congressman, Vern Buchanan, who's chair of the House and Ways Committee, and also just like the most moderate Republican, I think, left in Congress. And the fact that he endorsed Trump after everything is insane. Even these two congressmen who DeSantis gerrymandered illegally Florida's districts to like get these two congressmen, assured victory, they turned and endorsed Trump. So this is what's so surprising about it. I mean, back in January, I was like, DeSantis is going to win. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the winds can change real fast. And I think, you know, people hadn't yet really heard him talk in public much. And the more he's being seen, I think the less people like him. Dude has zero swag. I mean, he talks like Rabbi Glickman from Seinfeld. This is very weird cadence, very effete, and just no charisma. And so being the zero charisma candidate that he is, the only way he could get attention was by passing policy, by passing just insane, like, internet brain-addled policy. And the problem, and my theory here, and this is, I talk about this on my podcast, is that passing policy is bad politics. Like, you don't want to do that, actually. It doesn't ever tend to work in your favor, because that means you're going to piss people off when you pass policy. If you just entertain people and let the machine, you know, move along in its merry way, I think you'll be much more successful, politically speaking.
Talk about a black pill. Because I guess if you're living in that kind of like a truly post-political, a post-legislative democracy, which I guess is what we're living in now, it's the candidate who's the most entertaining who wins. And I guess that's just Trump.
Absolutely.
And even when he's losing, he's still winning at being entertaining. So he still gets to be leader of the party. I, for a long time, I'm sure as you know, Florida was the butt of a lot of jokes. There was the whole Florida man meme. There was the people on bath salts eating each other's faces off in Florida. Like, people were like slowly mutating into gator humanoids or something like that. And then in just the last couple of years, I've seen that turn, and it's almost completely 180'd where there's this new Florida meme where it's like, Florida is the promised land. Florida is paradise. Florida is where America still is. Florida is the new Texas or something like that, this kind of mentality. And I saw DeSantis as kind of being the personification of that, whether it was earned or not. And so now to see that it's kind of reverting back to the mean or something like that, the we're going back to the old Florida meme where Florida is a joke again. It's an interesting trajectory to me. And then you, as somebody who is a proud Floridian, what can you tell us about actually growing up there, actually being from Florida?
Well, you know, only 30% of Floridians are born in Florida, and I'm one of those 30%. But my folks weren't. My folks are from Chicago and Pittsburgh, and I don't think that's technically the Midwest, because I don't think that like cities are Midwestern. I don't think that Pittsburgh's Midwestern, and that's a whole other conversation.
Fair enough.
But
yeah, fair enough.
You know, my dad moved down here when he was like 10. My mom came down. She went to New College, which is in the news a lot today, and they just never left. And then they had me and my sister. And growing up in Sarasota, which is like an arts community, it's like one of the older cities in Florida. It's still like you're divorced from the history itself. Like you grow up not knowing what the place really is because you're a foreigner, and there weren't that many local people to really explain what it was in the first place. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I grew up like in like a I wouldn't call it a city, but it was like the urban area of Sarasota. Mm-hmm. And we still had like a big yard and like lots of nature around us. And I grew up like catching lizards in the backyard, and like really interacting with nature a lot. And only much later in life when I realized that those lizards I was catching were invasive. They were Cuban anoles, the brown anoles. And it broke my heart to think that like this nature that I had interacted with throughout my entire childhood was a fraud. And so I spent like growing up here in Florida, which was always very conservative and old, very old, like hating it, like wanting to get the hell out of it. And so I never really developed a strong connection to the land. I was always looking forward to leaving. And that's what I ended up doing. The second I graduated high school, I went and I lived in Nicaragua for a year. And then that like began like my travels, where I stayed away from Florida for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm. What were the lizards like in Nicaragua?
Like geckos. They were mostly, they're actually like entertainment, because the government would turn the electricity off all the time. So then you'd like put candles out and there would just be like hundreds of mosquitoes against the wall. And you just watch for like hours, just watch the lizards just like eat the mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. And of course you're like rooting for them, because you were getting torn up by, oh my God, the mosquitoes in Nicaragua were like the most intense I've ever experienced in my life.
They're little gecko angels, but those geckos were native, right?
Probably. I mean, Florida is like really unique when it comes to invasive species, because we have great biodiversity here. We were colonized by animals from the north, and all like the Caribbean species kind of stayed away. Like a couple things could like float over on logs. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we only had prior to probably like World War II, we only had like one or two native gecko species. And now we must have like 30 different kinds here from all over the world, largely because of the pet trade. In my backyard here, we have tokay geckos, which are beautiful, gigantic, mean as hell. You hear them all night long, and they're everywhere now in my neighborhood. Like I hear them all night long. So Florida was really ripe for invasion.
Well, so I've heard that Florida had like a bounty on iguanas.
We have lots of bounties. We have bounties on iguanas, okay, but bounties on pythons. I went python hunting with this guy whose name, I shit you not, was Dusty Crumb. We just spent like all night driving along these levees, like pointing spotlights into the bushes and trying to tackle giant Burmese pythons.
How did that go?
I didn't see a single one. But he had a 15-footer in his truck that he let me wear like a scarf. Nice. Just so I felt like, you know, it wasn't totally fruitless.
Well, I gotta say, any person I've ever met in my life whose name was Dusty has always been a real one.
Yeah, no, I've known quite a few Dusties, quite a few, two Dusties I've from my past overdosed on OxyContin. So,
Yeah.
yeah, it's a, I'm not gonna name my son Dusty, that's for sure.
So where'd you go from Nicaragua?
I went to college in Portland, Oregon, and I was there 5 years,
What was
and
Portland
then
like?
I
Wait,
went.
wait, wait, wait. Hold on. What years were you in Portland?
I was in Portland 2007 to about 2012.
Oh, okay. We would have been so
Yeah.
I was hanging out in Portland like 2010, 2011, so we would have actually been in Portland at the same time.
We could have run into each other at some coffee shop there.
We could have bumped shoulders at a food truck,
We
but
might have actually.
so here's the thing. When I first went to Portland, as I was in my early 20s, like I loved it. I mean, it was like euphoric. I know people hate on Portland because it's like hipster capital, whatever. They can all go fuck off and die because I fucking loved Portland. I had a blast. It was beautiful. The beer was cheap. The food was all really good. People were friendly as hell. I loved it, dude. It was like,
You
that's
ever
like,
go to Lutz Tavern?
maybe, I don't know. I went to a lot of taverns. I mean, it's a hazy now, but
Yeah.
there's a lot of cool ones.
I thought I was gonna stay in Portland forever for a minute.
Yeah.
Just because those summers were perfect. I never earned a summer before. Summer was always something you
Oh,
escaped growing up in Florida because it's hot as shit here. And after 9 months of just gray, low clouds, like the euphoria, the collective euphoria of the first bits of spring were amazing. I loved it there. And I started doing construction after I went to Reed College, and after that, I never wanted to sit in another library ever again.
Yeah,
I
understandable.
wasn't built for academia. I was really bad at it. I was like, I went from the smartest kid in public school in Florida to like the dumbest kid in college. And
What were you studying at college?
Reed has a classical sort of degree, so I just was the liberal arts was what I got.
Okay.
But I wrote my thesis on anti-doping policy and philosophy in the Olympics. So I was always like a sporty guy, which was a weird thing to be at Reed College.
So was it, it was tell me a little about this thesis. It's
Oh
the philosophy of
man.
getting juiced or what?
Yeah, so God, okay, I to prepare for this conversation, I went back in my own memory to access like the past 5 years. I have not looked at my thesis in a very long time, and every time I have looked at it, I like couldn't get past the first page because it was so fucking bad, like embarrassing. I am so embarrassed that I turned that thing in and passed. That's the other thing, is like I should not have passed. I should have failed out of that school, but I didn't. That's just also like the state of academia today. But the let me try to remember. So I was looking at the history of like the rules against using substances in the Olympics. If I remember correctly, like the first Olympics, one of the first races was won by some Italian guy who like overdosed on strychnine. Like they were taking strychnine to race because it like numbed them to fatigue or something.
Wow.
So there's been a history of cheating for a very long time, and
Well, 'cause hold
it
on,
wasn't
strychnine is a
until,
serious poison, right?
yeah, but they made some
Microdosing
mixture,
strychnine.
they were microdosing strychnine and brandy while they were like doing marathon races.
Right.
The science has progressed immensely since then. And I went into it with this like total like, fuck performance enhancing drugs, you're a cheater sort of mentality, to like leaving it being like, dude, let them fucking do it. That like it there are so many holes in this argument against taking drugs. And a lot of it had to do with like both, I think, the anti-drug era of the 1980s, but also like this idea of what it means to be human. And I think we revere athletes as like the purest kinds of humans.
Right.
But it turns out that, it doesn't work like that. I mean, if it's not cheat, like cheating and unfairness is like inherent in the game, and to focus on just the drug component seems kind of silly.
So after that, you were like, fuck it, I'm pro trend.
Dude, I have not yet done performance enhancing drugs. I'm I like, drugs are great, but there are some drugs I've always been like really wary of. Like I don't like using drugs to enhance performance. So I never did like Adderall or anything. I was like, I don't know. I was like, what if it just makes me like want to clean my room and I don't finish this paper? But doing Adderall to get fucked up and have fun, sure, that sounds great.
I've had multiple people tell me that when they do Adderall, or that they've tried to use Adderall to like get work done, and then they just end up masturbating for hours. I only ever took Adderall once, and I went completely bonkers, and I'm like, I'm never touching that stuff again. I was writing poems to the sun. I remember I went to work, and admittedly the day passed by in what felt like an hour, you know, like my 8-9 hour shift went by in almost no time. And then I remember drinking like 2 or 3 pitchers of beer and feeling nothing. And then just like riding my bike home, and someone who I was angry at emailed me. And then, so I wrote him basically like a short novel telling him to fuck off. And then like finally passed out at like 7 in the morning. And when I woke up the next day, I was like, I'm never fucking with that stuff again. Me and the Adderall don't mix.
I don't know. That sounds like a pretty interesting relationship to a drug that like deserves further exploration.
But the thing is that it didn't feel like, you know, it didn't feel like it didn't feel like a normal stimulant to me. It felt like being possessed. That's what it felt like. That's what I didn't like about it. It didn't really feel like I was in control. It felt like I was on like some weird roller coaster ride, like I'd been turned into an android or something like that, and something else was operating on me. I really didn't like it. It didn't like that feeling at all. And it's not like I haven't done other stimulants. I have.
It was just that one.
If I was gonna guess, I would say it's probably because the Adderall is too efficient. It's too strong of a stimulant. And then I know that the way that they make those capsules, they're like time released, but whatever. I was like, I think 21, 22 years old when this happened, but never fucked with it after that. But what was I thinking? Well, I wanted to say this. I loved Portland when I was a little upstart youngling. I thought it was like a little paradise, right? So when I finally got to go back to Portland recently, this last summer, I was kind of shocked with how fucked up it is now. Really shocked, actually. I mean,
because everywhere. Which way?
I'm sorry.
In which way is it fucked up?
Portland was a little bit sketchy. There's like a little bit of drug use going on, but this was this felt like almost apocalyptic. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate too much, but like I went to the you know, I was at the train station and it looked like 28 days later. It was just a bunch of people fucking thwacked out of their skulls, like foaming at the mouth, rolling around on the ground, screaming at nothing. There were no normal people around. It was just a bunch of like drug addled maniacs, basically. And then everywhere I looked, there's just people smoking heroin. Every store I went into, everything was completely locked up. You had to get a key to buy stuff. It was just,
you know, it returned to tradition. I mean, that was Portland. That was Portland before it got hipstered out. Yeah. Where I
it's
lived
reverting
in
back. Yeah. Okay.
Southeast Portland. And I was talking to people who had stuck around that neighborhood as we were gentrifying it. It got, I was living in a big house in Portland for $300 a month. It's crazy. But yeah, they were just talking about how like, yeah, like this used to be like a meth house, right? Like you were living in a former meth house, not that far removed. So
yeah, and I've heard about how like Seattle in the 90s, people thought that that city was just done, right? And the reason why like grunge, that became the grunge spot, is because that's where all the broke artists could go and live, you know, before the techies came in. And then I guess it's just like, it's kind of like similar to the Bay Area the last time I was there. I mean, there was so much shit in the streets of San Francisco that you had to like hopscotch around it. And I guess with all of these cities, what I've seen is like, it's now worst of both worlds. It's the worst levels of homelessness and drug use, and petty crime you could imagine, combined with everything is now also super expensive and you can't find a fucking normal burger spot anywhere because everything is like, has to be the crazy hipsterfied, foodie boutique stuff. So it's absolute worst of both worlds.
Cause my time, I went to Portland, maybe back in like 2019 was the last time I was there. And yeah, it looked very different. Mostly because I was there for the initial invasion of like the tech bros, who I think you know, fucked up Portland in a way that made me want to not be there.
Right.
But yeah, it's I eventually you'd think the tech bros are going to get chased out by the homeless, and then you know, you can have another art renaissance in that beautiful city. But yeah, I don't know. I my friends who are still in Portland, I'll talk to them about it. And during like the whole Proud Boy Antifa thing, you know, it's like, oh, that's just like, that's just one city block right there. Like, don't worry, it's not like that everywhere. It's fine. And I was like, yeah, that makes sense. So, yeah, I wonder to what degree it's exaggerated, but maybe it's like a lot worse than when I was last there.
Pretty much everywhere I went, it was like people shooting up or smoking heroin because it's been decriminalized now, or it's just not enforced anymore. And then I would say it was several city blocks that were pretty fucked up from the mini civil war that had been fought in the two summers before. I don't know, looked pretty fucked up to me. And I only bring this up, not to hate on Portland at all, because I actually love Portland, but I only bring this up because pretty much every big city I've been to in the last 2 or 3 years has been on this trajectory of both like hyper homelessness and hyper gentrification, kind of like just clashing, you know, face to face, where you have the you have like a bunch of people who are completely cracked out of their skulls, and then people trying to buy like a $20 bagel, right? But I went to Florida myself for the first time in my entire life last summer. And I have to say, I only saw Miami, but I have to say, I was very impressed with Miami. I could feel the Miami make America Florida vibes. I could feel it, because it's funny. Everybody's been making fun of Florida all this time, saying like Florida is like this dump. But actually, all these other cities I've been to, they're the cities that are fucked up. But when I was in Miami, it was incredibly nice. And I was kind of like, okay, I'm seeing why people move here. I'm seeing why. I didn't know that statistic you gave me. I didn't know that 2/3 of the population are immigrants.
Four immigrants. Yeah. Yeah. So
I could see why.
Yeah. I wish people would stop coming here. I am a,
how's your time?
I am a total xenophobe now. I am a build that wall along the northern
build the wall to keep them out of Florida.
Stop coming here, please. The thing is, Florida, the entire thing is a Ponzi scheme, and it makes sense that like people are coming to Florida like in the wake of, you know, Bitcoins and NFTs and whatever else, because this is a Ponzi scheme. Florida needs 1,000 people to move here every day to keep up this grift. Once those 1,000 people stop coming here, it's all going to fall apart. And I guess I'm like an accelerationist in that regard, because I want it to stop. Like, it needs to stop.
So what is the grift exactly? Like, why is it that Florida needs to import 1,000 people a day?
We don't have any income tax. Everything's property tax based here.
Oh shit!
And so
we also, this is making sense now.
We also are, you know, tourism and real estate are two biggest industries. We have a ton of industries here, and people just forget how goddamn big Florida is. It is gigantic. Mm-hmm. It is bigger than Italy, and it is also like still largely wild. I mean, we still have tons of open space here. You know, the coastal areas have been colonized for, you know, quite some time, and entirely every inch is like seawall and developed. But now the interior of Florida, which is also incredibly beautiful, is just being wiped out. And one of the Ponzi scheme elements that people are going to have to face very soon is our housing insurance crisis. It is getting astronomically expensive to live in Florida. Rent here in Sarasota is comparable to major cities now. And we're like this sleepy little like 70,000 person city. So eventually, like once people stop moving here, once all that new money and income for construction, for realtors like dries up, then it's just like, well, where's the money going to come from? Where's the industry? And the funny thing too is like, as you develop more and more of Florida's land, there's less reason for people to come visit it for tourist reasons. Because we were destroying the very thing that people come here to live here for. Mm-hmm. So that's it's all one giant Ponzi scheme, man.
So, I mean, if you had to guess, how many years do you think Florida has left?
It's going to turn into like an archipelago, I think, of like areas that are livable and areas that aren't. Soon people will not be able to live here because it's just going to be too expensive. And you will not be able to have housing insurance. We already have the most expensive car insurance in the country. So it's, and you absolutely have to have a car here. I mean, that's part of the reason why it's hard for homeless people, because like there's no way to get around. And that's the same thing with Miami. I mean, if you were driving around Miami, you'll see it's just like, damn, like it, you need a car. There's so many bridges and interstates in between little like neighborhoods. It's probably the same reason why you don't see any like homeless people in Irvine either. It's like that, that sort of city planning prevents vagrancy. I'm pro homeless. Like I'll take a homeless person over a fucking tech bro any day. I have a buddy who he's a stand-up comic, which I normally hate stand-up comics. But he's this Bosnian refugee who lives in a van, and he just like travels the country and performs for free at homeless shelters. And I went around with him to some homeless shelters, and he like had, it's like he's the most humanity of any person I've ever met. It was the most beautiful thing. So your question was, how many years does Florida have left?
If you had to guess, yeah.
Well, it's not going to be sea level rise that drives people out of Florida initially. I think it's going to be cost. And that the cost is going to explode, is going to become pretty significant, I think, in the next 10 years. But the, the water thing that people don't talk about, the water thing that's going to really make Florida unlivable, is like we're poisoning this place.
Right, right.
We borrow from the aquifer. It's already, you know, we're already drawing way too much water from it. But we're also dumping toxic chemicals into it. And we also have these really awful algae blooms that have become seasonal. They used to be, you know, like every, you know, handful of years, but now every single year we have these toxic algae blooms that kill everything in the water, and they're causing significant health issues for the people that breathe the air in. So there are just like these, all these things are just going to like start happening with greater and greater frequency, and I think that'll drive people away, and only the true believers will stay.
Only the, all right, so it's only going to be the people who want to live in toxic gator country who will stay in Florida. It'll be the true survivalists, the new frontiersmen.
It'll be the original Florida man. Yeah, I think. This place is great, man.
The Florida men won't inherit the earth.
Yeah.
The Florida man was actually the next stage in human evolution. That's what we couldn't accept.
No, and that's just like the X-Men, you know, we hate what's better than us.
Somebody make the meme where it says which way Florida man, and one of them is like some crazy like Everglades survivalist bath salt smoking maniac, and the other one is just like DeSantis crying.
I'll post it.
All right, great. So anyway, after you left Portland, after you absolutely revolutionized performance enhancing medicine studies, after you left Portland, where did you go?
I followed my college girlfriend out to New York City. She broke up with me. I was doing construction in Portland. I didn't know what I wanted to do.
Right.
And she was ambitious, and she broke up with me because she said I wasn't ambitious.
Yeah.
So I moved to New York to prove to her that like I can be ambitious. I'm worthy of you. And yeah. I moved to New York and I started writing.
Okay.
Yeah. And I got pretty lucky. Like one of my first bylines was the front page of the New York Times.
Nice.
Back when like I respected that publication. Now it's just like, yeah.
Regardless how you feel about New York Times, getting the New York Times I think is commendable. Was this woman impressed? Was she like, this motherfucker?
Oh,
first
man,
shot, New York Times.
I would run into her at a party.
Would you
week.
Run into her? Hold on. Would you run into her, or would you maybe be peeking at her Instagram and figuring out where you
I didn't have Instagram then. I didn't have Instagram yet.
All right.
Yeah, this
was okay. I see. Was it Facebook? Was it Twitter?
She, to her credit, she was like the least online person.
Okay.
And so, no, it was, you know, a lot of.
Were you guesstimating a little bit? Like, judging by her demographic, it's a Friday night. She'll probably be at this bar because she works here.
It was a party where we had mutual friends. And so there was a chance. So maybe, I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember.
I'm just saying a city of 8 million people. I don't know how much serendipity was having you run into.
I gotta say, my life is filled with serendipity. I don't know what it is, but like that shit just happens. So, I mean, it was serendipitous to be able to like get that gig at the Times when I did. So, I would run into her at a party.
Oh, did you see the New York Times by any chance?
I was a little more subtle than that. She was smoking a cigarette, which I'd never seen her do before. And she was like, "How's the writing going?" And I was like, "Oh, it's going pretty good, you know." And she's like, "Oh yeah, you get published anywhere?" And I was like, "Yeah, like the New York Times." And she's like, she just takes a big drag and blows it out. It's like, "Oh, cool." And I was just like, "I'm fucked. Like, there's nothing I can do. This is like, whatever." But hey, I'm super grateful it brought me to New York. It turned me into a writer, which is like what I get paid to do today. So, I'm glad it worked out that way, and I'm pretty glad I'm not with her. So,
right. Well, you know, I think that's how it has to work sometimes. I think women, or significant others, if I want to be ecumenical, they can be kind of like the trickster in your life that kind of gets you to go on the adventure. The MacGuffin
absolutely
gets the story going, even if it ends up disappearing halfway through the story, right? That sort of
God,
thing.
God bless women. God bless women.
So how long were you in New York?
I was in New York for about three or so years before I started like just traveling, just being like kind of a homeless, like,
Was there
traveler,
any
wanderer.
like, did you at any point you reached your limit on the Big Apple? Was there something that propelled you to leave, or you were just like, I'm ready to go?
There were a couple of, I mean, winter didn't help, but I had a book deal that I got fired from at the same time. Like, the next girl I was in love with left for Greece and broke up with me, and like winter was like hitting, and I was like, I gotta get the fuck out of here. And I had the opportunity to go to Cuba, and so I went to Cuba for 3 months. A family friend, who's this construction worker in his 50s, was having like debilitating back pain and was uninsured, and so he I speak Spanish, and he's like, "Isaac, I gotta go to Cuba, like, to try and get like emergency back surgery. Would you come with me?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure." So I followed him to Cuba, and that's kind of where like the whole traveling situation really took off for me.
So where'd you go from Cuba?
Well, in Cuba, I was supposed to write a story about the medical tourism industry, but my friend kind of bailed out because it's kind of illegal what he was doing at the time. And so
Right, okay.
he didn't want to do that. But he left and I stayed, and I just started playing basketball. And I made all these basketball friends in Havana. And they just like took me in and took me all over Havana, all over Cuba, just to play basketball. And it was so good. I mean, I feel really alienated. I hate tourists. Growing up in Florida, I fucking hate tourists. So
Right.
I hate being one. But I found that playing basketball like brought you to like on the level. Like, you were just like a teammate. You're just the homie. And I like, they wouldn't let me pay for anything. Like, everyone was like, "Oh, like, you know, they're gonna try and like scam you, like get your money." I would try and pay for dinner, and they'd be like, "No."
No, I guess. Well.
And so yeah, basketball like opened this whole thing to me, and I love basketball. And so I would end up going back to New York, back to my catering job, saving up money, and then I got I was following another girlfriend who left, the girlfriend who left for Greece. I planned this whole like basketball trip. I went on Birthright to get a free trip over to Israel.
Birthright to where? Oh,
yeah,
the other Florida.
The other Florida. I don't know. I got you know, yeah. No, it's not like Florida. There's some like elements that are similar. Ron DeSantis was just there, of course, and he has a very suspicious connection to the state of Israel. That people, once people start like peeling that onion back, they're gonna be like, "Oh, that's weird."
What's the other than the regular IPAC stuff? What's going on with DeSantis?
Well, I think he's a spook. I think he's like a deep state neocon plant, and so that he would have a special relationship with Israel kind of makes sense to me. Besides the first anti-BDS bill that he signed in Jerusalem when Trump changed the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, DeSantis is there to sign a Florida bill, which is very bizarre. When the Surfside condo collapsed, DeSantis called on the IDF search and rescue team to come and help.
Like, fly in from Israel into Florida?
Yeah, and to like help people out of the rubble.
Okay. I mean, I know that Florida has a very high Jewish population. Is this just to get that, whatever it is, that extra couple percentage points, get those elderly voters, those retired Jewish voters? I mean, is that what it's all about? I just feel like that the stuff, the special relationship between, like, you know, a Florida governor and Israel, to me seems very cynical, right? I mean, it's the same way that, you know, even like in New York City, how the different mayoral candidates were, like, you know, jumping over each other, trying to show how much they love Israel, when really it's just to get that that few percentage Jewish vote to hopefully swing things their way. That stuff always seemed purely cynical to me.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely cynical, but I think for me to have the IDF on speed dial to call them over for such a thing. And then the thing that I think drove a lot of conspiracy-minded folk crazy was the IDF then did a controlled demolition of the other half of the condo, which just is like, God damn, are they fucking with me? Are they, like, purposely fucking with me right now? So
when you're on Birthright in Israel, I take it they were not able to Torah pill you. They're not able to Zion pill you. You didn't.
I was always pro-Palestine. I grew up in that kind of a house.
Did you tell them that when you're on Birthright?
No, I kept my mouth shut because I know they'll kick you off, and I didn't want to have to pay them back for whatever. I was happy to, like, observe and just, like, watch the shit show unfold.
What was it like?
I mean, they're trying to get you to fuck each other. They're trying to, like, instill this, like, sense of this false sense of Judaism in you. Because when I was in Israel, it was, like, the least Jewish I've ever felt in my entire life. It had none of the cultural qualities that I was raised with. So the whole thing was very alienating and just very, overall, very bizarre. And I was there during, it was the summer 2014, and so Gaza was, like, launching rockets over, mm-hmm. which were really just, like, bottle rockets that the IDF had to spend, you know, like, $100,000 per Iron Dome missile to annihilate it. But mm-hmm. I would end up spending a little bit of time in Palestine after the all the other kids went back. But it was just very weird. I did not like Israel. wasn't surprising.
Well, so it was the Birthright tour. It's more religious than secular. I'm a little confused. From what I've heard from people.
Totally secular.
Okay, yeah, but it's more secular. That the emphasis is on the state, on getting married, on, like, encouraging you to join the military, that sort of thing.
It's to give you a story. I mean, that's what it is. It's you know, and we're gonna get into this, like, in a little bit, but it's about like giving you a narrative, and because Americans don't have those, we don't have stories to tell about ourselves. And nothing is more of a story than, like, a story of struggle, a story of, like, victimization. Like, that was how I became Jewish, and my own understanding of myself was through a story of, like, victimization. My father was a big garage sale guy, so he'd be driving around in his truck, and if we'd see a garage sale, he'd pull over, and he'd maybe stay in the truck, so I didn't, like, you know, you'd have to look out. Must have been, like, 8 or 9 at the time. And usually it takes a while to, like, go through things. But he came back kind of, like, quickly, and, like, I could tell he was upset. I was like, what happened? He's like, that guy said something. I'm like, I was like, well, what did he say? And he's like, oh, I was asking about this, like, chainsaw. And he said, yeah, don't Jew me down on it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what does that mean? So I really never heard that before. And my dad explained it to me. And that was, like, the moment I was like, I'm fucking Jewish. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when it was, like, born in my mind. And so I think for Birthright, it was giving all these kids with, like, a really flimsy sense of Judaism like a story to hold on to tell themselves, and a battle, like, there's something to fight for. That's kind of, I think, what they were imbuing in everybody. It was certainly not, like, a religious component whatsoever, but a fight.
And I take it you were not persuaded by this.
No, it was like, if you, like, had any awareness of any, like, any, like, Israeli or Palestinian history, you're like, yeah, this is all bullshit, you know? I was never swayed in any direction that way.
The people you were going on Birthright with, I mean, the people you were with, did they seem persuaded by this?
Oh, yeah, a lot of them. I mean, a lot of them went there to party. I mean, it was very clear, right. Like, they were just there to have a good time. There were people who were there who weren't Jewish at all. like anybody can go on Birthright. Like if you want a free trip, you can literally lie. Like they're not like Judaism, it's like being Jewish itself is like a pretty flimsy thing. So it's pretty easy to lie and do it.
So how you said you went to Palestine. What was that like? Did you make any Palestinian friends?
No, I went with this organization called Breaking the Silence, and they were former IDF soldiers who would take people into Palestine to like show them like what's going on. And it was pretty like awful. I mean, it was like being Palestinian fucking sucks. And you know, seeing the West Bank settlements and, you know, meeting the Palestinians whose, you know, lives are just constant like horror, you know, only like reaffirmed what I already believe. So it didn't surprise me.
So I imagine former IDF soldiers living in State of Israel who do this, they must be under pretty intense scrutiny, right?
I mean, we were aborted by IDF soldiers twice on that on one trip, where they came in, they made us all get off the bus, they searched the bus, they questioned us, we got back on, and it happened again. So you know, as an Israeli citizen, there are lines they won't cross. I had another friend who I went to college with, and she was half Israeli, and she would end up moving to Israel to live in Palestine, to live in Ramallah, and she was like a goat shepherd. And she would just like hang out with goat herders to be like witness, to make sure that like the IDF soldiers and like the West Bank settlers wouldn't fuck with them. Because if an Israeli citizen was there, they were much more reluctant to cause any trouble.
And how long did you end up spending in Israel, Palestine?
About a month.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what?
And then I did this like big like loop up through Europe. And back around and down to Greece, where I was just playing basketball. I was like, I would arrive in a city with no plans. I would go straight to like the biggest park that I knew there'd be basketball. And I would just start playing basketball with people. And then I would ask like someone if I could sleep on their couch. And I pretty much always got a yes.
You said you had an ex who went to Greece?
Yeah, she had a Fulbright scholarship and moved to Athens. And the plan was to end up there without, like, the basketball was, like, the disguise. Like, it's like, here, I'm just here to play basketball. I'm not here to see you.
Right. That's what I thought.
Yeah. It didn't work.
Well, did you ever end up finding her in Greece or what?
Yeah, I did. And my heart was broken into a million pieces. It's great.
Why? She was like, I'm a legit Fulbright scholar. I got a big Greek boyfriend.
You're a
now.
Bum. You're literally homeless.
Get out of here, basketball boy.
No, she was smart. She knew. Like, she's like, no, this like isn't gonna work.
She's like, I'm kind of a big deal now. Like,
yeah. I think wasn't Obama was a Rhodes or a Fulbright scholar? I can't remember.
Probably
part
both.
Of that and that NGO.
I think
system.
They made him in the same factory that they made DeSantis. Probably.
Yeah. But, no, it's the liberal version of being a Fulbright scholar is the liberal version of being a JAG officer in Guantanamo. Yeah,
precisely. So where from Greece then?
Back to New York, baby. And then I did I kept doing the basketball thing. I was just like crashing on couches in New York for a long time. I'd either like, you know, people would be like, oh, I'm gone, you can have it. Or I would stay with like my former editor at the New York Times. He would let me stay at his house a lot. So I was like in New York trying to figure out what was next. I got my catering job again, which was weird. That was like that was a weird job. Like working for fancy catering place. My favorite one was we catered for Robert Mercer. We did his mansion out in Owl's Head, Long Island.
Your life just turned the party down, is what this sounds like now.
It kind of was. There was like a party down element. Because
this was upper. Like, I take it this is upper echelon kind of catering.
This is billionaire shit. Billionaire shit.
Sounds like.
You know, they. I would end up getting demoted because I almost got in fights with some of the clients.
Oh, so it's just literally your life really was party down. Okay.
Yeah, except a lot gayer. Like, everybody was a
gayer
gay
than
actor.
Party down. That would like, you'd have to really
just way gayer than party. I was literally, I think, like the only straight guy. It was very fun.
Okay, how was that?
It was fine. It was fine. You know, like gay guys are great. They're very funny. It's very fun. People wanting to sleep with you constantly is like very fun. like that kind of attention, it can get a little exhausting, but like, you know, if you're a big guy, you can just say no pretty easily. It's just like, yeah, I'm done.
One of the many benefits of being a man.
I think, yeah, one of the many ones.
So sure. How long did you cater for?
On and off for a while. I got demoted and they made me the truck driver because I almost got in a fight with the son of the family that owned Coach bags.
Why? Why did you? Tell me about now. You got to tell us about this. How'd you almost get in a fight with this guy?
It was before Macy's Day Parade. So like they had a 3-story penthouse overlooking Central Park and the Natural History Museum on the West Side Drive. And you can see the balloons like right below their penthouse. And it's the night started off awful because they were making us wear Coach shit and they had shoes for us, but they only went up to size 12 and I wear size 14. So I was like, there's no fucking way I'm wearing these shoes all night. But like they made me. So I was like doing like Chinese foot binding while catering for hours. So I was already in a pretty bad mood. But the son is this fucking, you know, what you would expect of like a scion, you know? And he was really drunk. It's near the end of the night. He comes up to me. He's like, hey, you, hey, give me 3 fucking shots of tequila. And my manager was right by me. And I looked at my manager because this dude was like blackout. And I was like, okay, I'll get him for you. My manager kind of pulled me to the side. He's like, just like, don't, he'll forget. So I don't. I'm like busy doing something else. The son comes back up to me and he puts his fucking finger in my sternum. He's pushing his finger and like tapping my sternum. Be like, where's my fucking tequila? And I'm usually like, I don't get mad, but I saw red, dude. I was just like, what the like, you can't fucking touch me like that. And so I started like leaning into his finger. I wanted to break his finger and like, I'm clenching my fist. And my manager sees it, pulls me away, and I get this big talking to. And I was just like, all right, okay. And then like we like you, but like you can drive the van around now, which is fine.
How much longer did you stay after that?
I went go to LA. So I stayed in LA for about 9 months. And I got a big magazine article in the Los Angeles Magazine, another story about playing basketball when I was doing up there. So I was just like freelance writing when I wasn't catering or doing odd jobs. So I did that in LA. And then after LA, you know, doing the basketball thing there, that's when I was like, I decided to go to Tibet after that.
Finally, we get to Tibet.
Why are you talking? I think it's been an hour. We finally get to why.
I was wondering. I was like, how many loops are we gonna make until we finally get to Tibet?
You asked, man.
I wanted to see. I mean, I genuinely wanted to see. How long it would take to finally get to Tibet?
Well,
so
story, dude.
The Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
Before we talk about your Tibet adventure, I want to talk about the Dalai Lama. Okay. He asked a little boy to suck his tongue.
And yeah, yeah, yeah.
The thing is that when I first saw that video, it went viral, whatever. I didn't really think it was that bad because, I don't know, he's an old man. And I know that there is like a Tibetan custom of sticking your tongue out at people. And then other people were trying to say that it's like a common joke that elderly men tell in Tibet, where it's like you give the kid candy and then you say, I'm out of candy, suck my tongue or something like that. So it could be one of those lost in translation things. I don't really know. So, I mean, before anything else, I just, in your professional orientalist opinion, I mean, what the hell was going on there?
As one of the foremost Tibetologists in the country, the dude is old. I mean, all things aside, he is very old, even for his actual age. I think he's got to be like 84 now or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I saw him back in 2019 was when I met him. To say I met him is to say like I got to like wait in a line with a bunch of annoying Europeans and like get my picture taken with him and get him to bless one of those katas, which is like the silk scarf that they give people ceremonially. And when I saw him, I was like, he had like boogers and like it was like just crust on him. And he just looked like his eyes were glassy. It's just like I was like, oh, dude, like it's like my grandpa, you know, like my grandpa who had dementia and Alzheimer's.
Do you think maybe it's like a thing where he's an emperor has no clothes thing where people don't, even if he's in bad shape, like no one can actually say that to him and no one can go up and, you know, rub the Dalai Lama's eyes or something like that or wipe his face, that sort of thing?
I certainly never saw anyone. I mean, there were like a lot of caretakers, people like in between, which makes sense. You have like a line of like 100 strangers about to go like greet him. Like you had to go through like a security like process. I got to kind of skip the line because I was playing basketball with his security guards. So they like got me in. I didn't have, like any almost anyone can go see him, but it's just like it depends, you know. Whether they can like correct him or not, there wasn't like this air of like royalty in the same way that like where I've met like other like super rich or powerful people. Like he did have, there was like a smiling, nice old man quality to him. I didn't feel like I it was he was particularly holy. But I've also like met very few people who are like that. So I don't know. I think that like in this case where he was like fooling around with a kid, worst
Whoa,
case
whoa,
scenario,
whoa, whoa.
worst case scenario, he's like, I guess he's like a perverted old guy, which is like also like a big whatever to me. Like I don't care.
A few years back, I remember hearing him publicly complain about the monks having to be celibate, something like that. Maybe he's being misquoted, but it was
He
something
is
that,
a funny guy. Like,
you
if
know.
he is playful and jokes around a lot, and like English is probably his like fourth or fifth language, so
Yeah.
I could like you know reasonably say yeah, some stuff gets lost in translation. You know, humor there is very different than humor here. But like considering his closeness with the West, it's like wouldn't you have, you probably would know better by now. You know,
Yeah,
it's not
but
like he's like a hermit who had never been exposed to the West and our culture. So,
But he, unlike, you know, the Pope, who at some point chose to be a priest and chose a life of celibacy, the Dalai Lama was born into it. And that always seemed pretty rough to me. You're told from the time you're a child, you're the leader of this, you're the spiritual leader of the of this people, of this nation, and you're to be celibate for the rest of your life. Sounds pretty brutal to me. You never got a choice in the matter.
Yeah, but you think by like that, I hope my dick doesn't work when I'm in my 80s. I like hope it happens a lot sooner than that. Like the last thing I'd ever want to be is a horny old man. So
Sure,
I
but you got
guess,
to use that dick as a young man. If you got to be 80 years old, you never even got to use your dick because there's people who've been following you around all this time telling you you're not allowed to ever have sex. That's just been cosmically decided that you don't get to engage in that ever.
but like.
I think that would drive most men insane. I don't know how they must have been, and then I wonder, maybe we get into it a little bit. I mean, I imagine there's a weird sexual tension in Tibet. That's just how I would think of it. If you have this whole class of monks who aren't ever supposed to have sex.
So I spent a lot of time with some like monks in their like early t I couldn't really tell actually how old they were. I'm guessing they're in their early 20s. Just playing basketball. And there is like the culture of Tibet, there's a lot more like affection, like a lot more holding, you know, and touching. In a way than you know obviously we do in like the Protestant West. There were time I went out camping on like a monk holiday with them, and there were times when it felt like there was some like it felt inappropriate in a way. It's like no, we don't like I don't like in I interact with children that way. And as for like the sexuality out there, like there didn't seem it wasn't present. Like there wasn't talk about sex. I will say like the Tibetan people in all my travels were like the least horny people I've ever met in my life. And I remember talking about like taboos being like, oh, like is there a word for like a gay guy or something like that? And they're like, this I could be completely wrong here. This is what I was told by Tibetans out there. Like, oh yeah, like no, there's not like really actually a word for that. Like the concept doesn't even seem to exist in the same way as it does here. The only taboo that they were told me like made people uncomfortable or was weird was like incest. And I remember being in a yurt with like some like a big family, and a song came on the radio, and like abruptly like a bunch of the kids left. And I was like, "What was that about?" I'm like, "Oh, like that was a love song that came on, and those were cousins, and they didn't want to be like they didn't want to listen to the song together." I was like, oh, that's very weird. That's but I guess it makes sense when you think about like the nomadic lifestyle, like out in the country like that. It's just like, don't do that. But at the same
I
time,
would
like,
say, yeah, I was going to say, if there's a taboo around incest, that means that that's because incest has been a problem. That's like, that's something that's going on out there, or has at some point in their history was going on. Otherwise, why would the taboo be that intense? I mean, it's interesting. You won't listen to a love song with your cousins. It's almost like, you know, I think most people in the West now know that very special, weird agony of watching a film with your parents and having like a sex scene come on. And like, even me, who grew up with like very liberal, pretty lax parents, like, it's still a little bit uncomfortable if that scene goes on for too long. You just don't want to be watching that with your parents. Whatever weird Freudian Oedipal incest revulsion thing gets activated. And but then because of our culture, you have to act like it's not there at all. You have to be polite about it and just be like, oh, I have no, just everything's fine, everything's fine. So it's interesting. It's interesting that like the Tibetan version of that is you don't even listen to a love song with a relative. It's not even your parents, it's your cousins, right? But that also tells me there's something, there has to be some kind of like, that was actually a problem in their culture, incest. That's like a common temptation. I guess if you're living out in remote regions, it sort of makes sense. But then, you know,
yeah,
you don't know.
You don't have like, you don't have your own room. You like live in a yurt. Like there is no separation. Like, and that was the other thing too, is, you know, they're like, they get married very young in Tibet. And they have families and they live in these like very small places together where like everyone's sleeping in the same bed. And so they're like having sex with each other, like while their kids are like right next to them. So, and like, that was also something that we used to do before, you know, that'll like change for us. But yeah, it's still a very old way of living out there in Tibet, but also Dalai Lama, not in Tibet, in India, which is an incredibly horny place. Oh my God. So maybe like his time, he spent too much time with Indians and he got really horny. I don't know.
I gotta say, like, the horniest guys on the internet, that stereotype is there for a reason. I don't know what it is about Indian society that has produced that. I mean, do you have, can you can you speak to that a little bit? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, why Indian guys,
do you have
so
any
horny?
Theory on what, why is there this extreme horniness?
I think you and I were messaging each other about this, and I had like a theory about how matrilineal cultures like create male deviants, which is why I think like Jewish guys are also like weirdly horny. But as for, I think, I mean, it's weird for Indians to be so horny, but also like in all the places I've visited, like there are like, there's sex work everywhere I've been, like that was pretty upfront and obvious, even in China. But in India, like it was not like the idea of like dating an Indian girl was just like out of the question. Like, you don't do that. And the Indian women, like, just like, they don't really hang out with each other. Like, to me, it was very separate outside of like the home, like who spent time with who. Okay. And I think that what's made Indian guys like unbearably horny, in spite of like writing, I guess, like the book on how to fuck, is like they don't fuck. And the internet, which is everywhere in India, has really messed them up. And it's given them these ideas, particularly about like Western women. Like, if any of your listeners are a Western woman in India, first of all, don't go to India. Like, you don't have to go there. Secondly, if you're gonna go, wear a wedding ring. They seem to respect the institution, but if you're not wearing a wedding ring, you are like a slut. That's how they see you. And one of the things that they'll do, two things that they do is very weird. First one is like, if they go up and take a picture with you, you're a girl, especially a blonde girl, they will take a picture and then they'll go home and they'll show their friends and they'll be like, I fucked her. Like, it's like they're listening to
anyone believe
cum
that
town
though?
Or something.
Does anyone,
I don't know,
that?
Man. Like, it doesn't matter at that point. It's like, it still is like created this culture of like unbearable horniness. And so this idea of like Western women being loose and available.
What is it about the matrilineal societies that you think that breeds this sort of like turbo horny male?
All right, you're gonna have to chew on this with me because I have not really thought it out too much. But I think that especially like for Jewish men, the power of the woman in the home, you know, there's got to be some like especially like weird Freudian psychosexuality that comes out of that.
I was thinking it could be like anima, some kind of anima possession thing, to put it in Jungian terms. It could be an anima possession thing where it's like you grow up with this strong, if you grow up with a strong maternal figure who is the center of the home, who you are especially attached to, and who you're encouraged to be attached to, then unconsciously it's like the woman and the feminine is life itself. And eventually that's going to express itself in like maybe like an extreme erotic mania. That would be I think my best way of making sense of that, if we think that such a thing is actually the case.
Whereas like I think with Protestants, like when you think about sexual deviancy, it seems to be like a homosexuality, like that's where like sexual deviancy seems to manifest itself in like weird ways, because of their homophobia, which is why like so many serious Protestants who have like weird sexual hangups, right?
What would that be?
You know,
I'm guessing maybe the Protestant mentality would be like, well, you're supposed to break away from the mother. You're supposed to get out there and make money, mm-hmm. But you're not supposed to spend it, right? So you just have to. You're supposed to have big swollen balls that you don't expend. So it's like then it's like becomes some weird masculine daddy issues, which eventually becomes like, well, what I really want is man on man, right? Then there's no mommy for me to expend on.
Yes. Oh, dude, this should be a dissertation right here. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I subscribe to this, but I mean, it kind of makes sense. I kind of see it.
I don't know, but you know, we're to bring things back to the Dalai Lama.
Please, yes. Thank you. Let's bring things back to the Dalai Lama.
You know, I don't care. Like that whole thing to me, it's just like it's a big whatever for me. The thing that is like a legitimate criticism of the Dalai Lama is like the weird, you know, parapolitical, like CIA like component. But even then, I don't subscribe to the whole like tanky, oh, the Dalai Lama just wants his slaves back. Sort of shtick. I find that intolerable as well. Like I find this whole sort of thing that like China liberated Tibet because Tibet was an awful place. Like they sound like the kinds of people who are excusing like Spanish colonialism. Yeah,
that's what always drove me nuts. Is that that's every colonizer's argument, is that I'm not oppressing them. I was liberating these savages. It is the same type of argument. And then also my view was always that Mao taking over Tibet was just real politic, had nothing to do with liberating Tibet. Just like he didn't just want this big region, this big backyard region that basically represented the old ways, the old, you know, the old traditions, the ancient China,
and a military geopolitical buffer from the West,
right?
I mean, like,
right.
You know, that's very like, because if they cross over into Tibet over the Himalayas, like it's over. Like that's a pretty big chunk of land.
There's just no strategic or political reason to why you would allow Tibet to be its own thing. I mean, maybe like if America had like a massive civil war, and then I don't know, what are you going to do? You're just going to let Canada just sit there unmolested? No, I don't think so. Right? There would be some bullshit about we have to liberate Canada, something like that.
I would love to invade Canada. They deserve it. They got it coming.
We tried it once. We did try it once. People forget the one time the U.S. invaded Canada in the War of 1812. The Canadians did kick us back, right? And we never talk about it, but they remember it.
Damn.
The only time the U.S. and Canada ever actually scrapped, Canada did win, and we never bring
it
up.
Damn, that's so embarrassing.
I mean, it was a War of 1812. It was early in the game. Okay, I mean, today it would be over pretty quickly.
We haven't had a lot of dubs, man. You know, over the years, it's pretty bad. If we were a boxer and you looked at our like win, loss, draw record, you'd be like, you suck.
But the funny thing is, it would be like we won all our major battles, but then for some reason we like get into stupid bar fights. That's the thing. America's like this incredible champion fighter who in every like title fight they've ever been in has won, but then for some reason in like the second half of our career we just get into the dumbest fucking drunkest fights, bar fights we possibly could, with people who we should be able to beat, but for some reason, because we're just so high on our own supply, we allow ourselves to get knocked over the head. I'm dragging this metaphor out too far, but basically I'm saying We got into a prolonged bar fight with the Taliban, and eventually the Taliban just bled us out, right? Same thing with the Viet Cong. But anyway, to bring it back to the Dalai Lama. How long were you in India, Tibet?
I spent Tibet. 2 summers in China and Tibet, and then the summer 2019 in India. And the whole time I was there, I was either coaching or playing basketball. And I got that in Tibet initially. There's like a pretty cool like community of like basketball heads. Like we all kind of know each other in one way or another, or at least we're like a degree or two removed from each other. So it was an American out in Tibet who was coaching in this like remote village called Ritoma out in the Tibetan Autonomous Prefecture. So in Tibet, you have like two areas. You have the prefecture and the region. The region is where Lhasa is, and that's like hyper-militarized. You can't go there without like constant like Chinese supervision. But in the prefecture, it's way bigger, and you can just go, and like they don't care. So you know, the idea that I had before going out to Tibet, that like Tibetans were like the Chinese Palestinians, you know, they were oppressed. And it's not great being Tibetan. You're a second class citizen versus the Han Chinese. Like you get the shitty jobs, and they're all like urbanizing and moving like young Tibetans out of the countryside and into the cities and integrating.
But Chinese people aren't moving into Tibet, right?
They are. Yes, they're going both directions. Yeah, okay. Chinese people are moving into Tibet.
Huh.
There was like a Chinese spy in the village where I lived, and everyone would be like, "That's the spy's house." And it was kind of like, it was like the nosy neighbor, you know, like, oh, that's the cat lady right there, you know, like nobody made a big deal out of it. There were limitations on what we could do out there. Like I couldn't teach them anything but basketball. Teaching them English was not allowed. And they couldn't teach us anything. Like, you know, I went there with like spiritual ideations. Like I was like, oh, I'm going to go to the source, and I'm like, real Tibetan monks are going to fucking teach me how to like escape this shit. No, it wasn't like that at all.
They're just going to teach you how to ball. You're going to teach them how to ball, and they're going to...
Yeah. Well, they taught... I mean, I learned, you know. I mean, for me, like, basketball is the spiritual practice. That's, like, the association I made. That's why I wanted to do basketball in Tibet and with Buddhists, because, like, basketball, for a long time now, has been my spiritual practice.
Man, I mean, ball... Okay, well, I'm sorry, but what you just said could get you on the New York Times bestseller list.
Goal, dude. That was the plan. Basketball and Buddhism. That was what I was doing. That was the whole thing. That was the whole plan.
the mandala of ballin.
Manbala. I met a guy who I did a meditation retreat out in like San Bernardino or San Fernando, somewhere outside of San Diego. It was a Thich Nhat Hanh village. He was like the Vietnamese Zen Buddhist. And I met a guy there who was this like former college basketball player who was writing a book. It was called Buddha Baller or something like that. And I was just like, I was furious at first. I was like, that's my fucking idea. But then I was like talking to him, and he showed me his book, and I was like, go ahead, dude. That's the dumbest shit I've ever heard.
Well, what was it actually like playing basketball with these Buddhist monks?
They were dirty as hell. They're the dirtiest players I've ever played with in my life. One American got his nose like knocked clean off his face. Like had to go to a hospital like 5 hours away to get his nose like fixed.
Damn.
It wasn't like malicious.
This has got to be where all the pent up energy goes, though, right? That would be my theory.
I think like when you talk to Tibetans about why the monks are stronger, it's because like, oh, they just like, you know, get to play all day. They just get to like work out all day. They are the Chads of Tibet. But it was really interesting. It was wild playing out in Tibet, because like Tibet, like you're like sometimes 10,000 feet above sea level. And I was lucky not to have, altitude sickness, but playing basketball at 10,000 feet was insane. Like I would run down the court, run back, and I literally thought I was going to die. But then you recover so quickly. So it was like the monks were just like running circles around me. Like I could only do so much. I mean, I was like way taller than all of them, way bigger. but like they would run me into the ground and kick my ass.
You're basically a dinosaur. You're basically a dinosaur when the back when the atmosphere started to change and the planet couldn't support big animals anymore.
Exactly.
Megafauna anymore.
But I will say, like, this is cheating to bring it back to the doping, you know, policy, whatever. When I went back to China and I was playing basketball in Shanghai after being in Tibet for months, I was a monster. Like I could not believe how, like, I just couldn't get tired. And I was just like running nonstop. So like high altitude training is real, and that's unfair. You shouldn't be able to do that and then train.
You went full Goku.
Exactly. Yeah.
You went Super Saiyan on these suckers. How did you get back to the US? Because I said you said 2019 was the last time you were in Tibet.
That was when I was in India. The plan was I was going to go back to India. I wanted to build a basketball court with a roof for where I was in Dharamsala, because there were mm-hmm. like two basketball courts. Only one was really played on, but it was exposed to the elements and, you know, monsoon, like right. heat. Like it made playing basketball there very, very difficult. So the plan was, and the promise I made to all my Tibetan and Indian friends out there was, I'm coming back, baby. I'm going to build you guys a court. And then boom, fucking COVID hit, and that changed a little bit of everything.
Yeah. So where did you end up spending the pandemic?
Mostly in Florida.
So this is finally when we get back to Florida.
Full circle, man. Full circle.
Return to Florida.
It's a cliche, man. You know, like the whole thing for me, traveling, playing basketball, chasing like a heartbreak. I was, and it was like a rejection, my initial rejection of Florida. And it was like mm-hmm. me trying to, like, where do I belong, man? Where should I be? And I travel the world looking for like my home, like my original Instagram account. God, this is so fucking embarrassing. But my original Instagram handle for it, Gluten Daddy, was courting the world. That was my god. That was my fucking Instagram. That was the name of my book, dude. That's the name of the book. And I am. Yeah. I knew it was a terrible title when some girl named Courtney reached out to me, being like, "Hey, can I buy the handle from you
for my food blog?" Yeah, I would be embarrassed too, my dude.
Yeah, really bad, really fucking bad.
I thought Mandala of Ballin was corny. You actually topped it,
dude. Okay, first of all, embrace the corn. We've got to cringe our way.
Cringe is how you win. That is how the world works now, actually. Yeah.
Is how the world works. And the cringy thing was like coming back to Florida and like being like, oh my God, this was home all along. Like, this mm-hmm. is where I belong. Like Buddhism, I would never call my, I never call myself a Buddhist because it was so fucking embarrassing. Like
that, too cringe even for you. Yeah. So.
Yeah. You know, I would never call myself that. But yeah, now like if people want to ask me what I am, I was like, I'm a Floridian. This is where it's at. Because it's all about local now. It's all about like whatever you can touch. That's it. That's the only thing that matters anymore. Can you reach out and touch it?
Okay. So now you're fully Florida pilled and you're committed to stay in Florida even through the apocalypse.
I at least want to be here to document the apocalypse. Okay. Like whether I stay until I'm dead or not, it depends.
I mean, I'm having this vision of you in like this swamp ashram, maybe like surrounded by gators, but the gators don't touch you because you're so enlightened or something like that, and you're like showing some Florida Everglade feral children how to play basketball.
I believe in the power of like the utterance, like saying something out loud will make it real. So uh-huh. I think you just determined my future. You just sealed my fate.
The true end of your journey. I've given you the true end of your journey. Excellent. Yeah.
No, I mean, my plan right now is to run for mayor. I'm going to run for mayor of Sarasota.
Yeah. The rent is too high.
Rent is too damn high. Yeah.
Rent is too damn high party. I think you could be the Florida man version of that. Actually, Florida Man Party would be the name of your party.
Ooh, yeah, Florida Man, the Florida Man Party. That's pretty good. Yeah.
Yes.
I'll credit you with that. You can be my campaign advisor.
All right, Isaac. Where can people find you? Is there anyone you want to give a shout out to, including yourself?
Listen to my podcast, Cheeseburger in Babylon. If you want to follow me on Instagram, it's gluten_daddy. Don't read any of my latest writing. It's not worthwhile. It's not. I'll be writing some cool stuff pretty soon. And maybe that'll find their way to people. But yeah, thanks for having me, man. It's really fun. I love making internet friends. I really do. I'm way into it.
I mean, internet friends are kind of the only thing that makes all the bullshit that we put up with on here and all the brain rot and all the irreparable
damage. I've made so many like cool friends. I'm meeting them like IRL and like working with them like and it's a blast. If you can touch it, it's real. One day, like, come to Florida, man. I'll host you. I'll take you out. We'll go gator wrestling.
Okay, excellent. Absolutely, to gator wrestling.
That's it. I got nobody else to talk. Shout out to my mom, my dad, my sister. I love them so much.